call to order docket numbers 2560 and 2561, the residential property rate of appeal hearing of Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange, directed by Article 5.26-1 of Senate Bill 14, enacted by the 78th Texas Legislature. I'm Jose Montemayor, Commissioner of Insurance. It's approximately 9:30 a.m., September the 5th, 2003. Notice of this hearing was posted at the Texas Register on August 18, 2003. Pursuant to pre-hearing consolidation order issued on August 22, 2003, docket numbers 2550 and 2561 had been consolidated for the purpose of this appeals hearing. This hearing is open to the public. The purpose of this appeals hearing is to receive testimony and evidence for a determination of whether the rate reduction notification issued to Farmers Exchange and Fires Exchange by the department be affirmed, or whether a greater or lesser reduction should be ordered. I would also like to introduce members of the department staff here at the podium with me, my general counsel, Gene Jarman, and Norma Garcia, Deputy Commissioner, Legal and Compliance, and Janae Bukowski, Senior Actuary, Property and Casualty Division. Our goal is to complete this hearing today. We have a number of hearings to conclude, and I will ask everyone to cooperate to the greatest extent possible. For the benefit of the record and any in the court reporter, I will now ask each counsel for each party here to identify themselves and whom they represent. So if you would, please make your announcements at this time, Mr.
Commissioner, I'm Tom Rogers from Jackson Walker, representing Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange. With me is Steve Weinstein from Barger & Wolin, representing Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange. I also have Alexander Bourgeois, who is also with Jackson Walker. And from Farmers today, I have, going from left to right, Jim Snickers, Brian Deepals, Ben Tucker, and then Irene Bass, whom you know.
Welcome. Counsel?
Yes, good morning, Commissioner. Catherine Ryer, I'm representing the staff of the Texas Department of Insurance. I have with me my co-counsel, Sylvia Delgado. I also have sitting with me at counsel table our outside expert, Dr. Mark Crawshaw.
Thank you. Does either party have any preliminary matters that they wish to present at this time?
Yes, Commissioner. Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange have a few preliminary matters. The first concerns the time for the hearing. I anticipate we will need all day for this hearing, although we're only scheduled for 9:30 to noon, and wanted to let the commissioner know that right up front. And I understand that the State Farm hearing went extra innings, as it were, so we may have to go extra innings as well in order to get everything done and make our appellate record. The second issue I have as a preliminary matter is the absence of Dr. David Appel. When this matter was set for hearing for September 5, I notified Mr. Jarman that Dr. Appel was unavailable for this date and that he would be testifying on behalf of Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange. And I suggested that we had a number of alternatives to deal with that, one of which was to postpone the hearing to a date when Dr. Appel could be available, or keep the hearing open so that we could recall Dr. Appel to rebut any testimony as necessary from Betty Patterson. The way it was dealt with at the pre-hearing conference, Mr. Jarman wouldn't continue the hearing, as you can tell from the fact we're all here today, and allowed that we would have 4 pages of rebuttal testimony for Dr. Appel. The department at that hearing, pre-hearing conference, suggested we again take up the issue with you to see how we would resolve it. I have some suggestions. I don't want to continue today's hearing, but if we can't get the absence of Dr. Appel resolved, then I have no alternative but to move for a continuance and reconvene the hearing at a time when Dr. Appel can be here. The other alternative is to leave this hearing open today so that we can call Dr. Appel next week and present his rebuttal testimony. Now, the importance of Dr. Appel is that the code now defines statutorily what inadequate means. And inadequate is now defined at 5.142 as follows. inadequate if the rate is insufficient to sustain projected losses and expenses to which the rate applies, and continued use of the rate, A, endangers the solvency of an insurer using the rate, or B, has the effect of substantially lessening competition or creating a monopoly within any market. The department has known that has been the definition since these appeals were filed and the notice of hearings went out. This morning at 9 o'clock, I was delivered the testimony of Betty Patterson, which I'm holding up now, consisting of two affidavits. I would guess that there are probably 600 pages of documents here. The exhibits to the affidavits aren't labeled. I can't make heads or tails of what they are other than things I have seen before. And she purports to testify that the rate reduction of 17.5% determined by the Texas Department of Insurance for Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange meets the adequacy standard defined by the legislature in Article 5.142. So, having had this now for approximately 45 minutes, and not having Dr. Appel here to rebut that, poses a problem to us in being able to adequately present our case to sustain our burden of proof. So what I'm going to ask the commissioner to do is either, one, recess this hearing, or two, leave the hearing open so that we can recall Dr. Appel live next week. And we would recall him for the purposes of rebutting his testimony of Betty Patterson.
Anything else?
The second preliminary matter I have goes to the jurisdiction, and I am making my appellate record here, Commissioner. We have taken this issue up with Mr. Jarman. It was denied. I want to take it up with you simply because Article 5.26-1 provides at Section 4 regarding this hearing that the Commissioner shall conduct a hearing and issue an order on the insurer's appeal. And I want the Commissioner's ruling on this issue. We have filed this morning a motion to set aside rate determination by the Texas Department of Insurance and serve copies on counsel, and you have a copy up there. The gist of that motion is that, put simply, the department does not have jurisdiction over Farmers Insurance Exchange or Fire Insurance Exchange under Texas Insurance Code Article 5.26-1 to determine the rates for the exchanges. As the Commissioner is aware, reciprocal or interinsurance exchanges enjoy a general statutory exemption from the insurance laws of the state of Texas. Texas Insurance Code Section 942.003A provides, an exchange is exempt from the operation of all insurance laws of this state, except as specifically provided in this chapter, or unless exchanges are specifically mentioned in the other law. So there's a two-pronged test. One, does Chapter 942 make Article 5.26-1 specifically applicable to reciprocal or insurance exchanges? Or two, does 5.261 itself make it specifically applicable to exchanges? Now, curiously enough, when the legislature promulgated SB 14, which contained Article 5.26-1, they also amended Section 942.003B. And I'm sure that everybody here at this point has read SB 14 from cover to cover, word for word, and every jot and tittle. But when the legislature amended Section B, they did not make Article 5.26-1 specifically applicable to reciprocal or interinsurance exchanges. So, under the first prong of the test, under Section 942.003A, Chapter 942 does not make Article 5.26-1, applicable to reciprocal or air insurance exchanges. The second prong of the test is we look to Article 5.26-1, and the test is, are exchanges, quote, specifically mentioned, close quote, in Article 5.26-1. Now, on this point, the department and the exchanges agreed. At the pre-hearing conference in this matter, Ms. Ryer conceded that Article 5.26-1 does not specifically mention exchanges. She stated, as he, referring to me, correctly pointed out, Article 5.26-1 does not specifically state interinsurance exchanges. That's the pre-hearing transcript, page 50, line 24 to page 51, line 1. So since Article 5.26-1 does not specifically mention exchanges, and Commissioner, you can read it from front to back, and you not see the word exchange in there, you not see the word interinsurance or reciprocal in there. It does not apply to the exchanges. The Supreme Court had occasion fairly recently in 2000 in Fireman's Fund County Mutual Insurance Company versus Heidi, H-I-D-I, to address the statutory exemption that exists for county mutuals. And as the Commissioner knows, there are a number of specialty type insurers doing business in Texas, county mutuals, fraternal benefit societies, reciprocal exchanges, and so on, that enjoy a general statutory exemption from the other insurance laws of the state of Texas. In Fireman's Fund County Mutual Insurance Company, which is at 13 Southwest 3rd, 767, the Texas Supreme Court addressed the exemption for county mutuals, which has the same two-prong test that we see for reciprocal exchanges at section 942.003A. In Fireman's Fund versus Heidi, the Supreme Court made it clear, stating, for a statute to apply to county mutuals, and here we can simply substitute exchanges, it must either, one, be enumerated in Article 17.22, or be made applicable to county mutuals by its specific terms. Even if a statute would otherwise govern county mutuals, it will not apply to them if it does not satisfy either of these requirements. The exemption trumps generally applicable statutes. So under the law of the state of Texas, it is clear that Article 5.26-1 does not apply to Farmers Insurance Exchange. It does not apply to Fire Insurance Exchange. It is no legislative grant of authority to either the Department of Insurance or to the Commission to make a determination of the rates for the exchanges. As you know, the rule of law in Texas is that the department may only exercise that authority conferred upon it by statute in clear and unmistakable terms. The legislature, when it promulgated Article 5.26-1, did not grant the department authority to determine the rates of the exchanges. Accordingly, pursuant to our motion, we are requesting that the commissioner set aside the rate determination that the department purportedly made for the two exchanges under Article 5.26-1. The reason it would be an unlawful rate because it's not authorized by statute. It's void and of no effect, and as the commissioner has stated in the past, he can't promulgate an unlawful rate. So simply put, we have no jurisdiction here.
Anything else?
One last item before I turn it over to Mr. Weinstein. And that concerns the procedure for today. The statute clearly calls in Article 5.26-1 for an evidentiary hearing. The department's own rules at 28 TAC Section 1.2, open parent, 7, closed parent, defines this proceeding as a contested case. 1.27 defines a contested case as a proceeding including but not restricted to rate making and licensing, in which the legal rights, duties, or privileges of a party are to be determined by the board, the commissioner, or fire marshal after an opportunity for adjudicative hearing, provided it does not include certain proceedings that are not applicable here. Mr. Jarman, however, has advised us that the department's view is this is not a contested case. So I am at somewhat of a loss to understand what this is. Article 5.26-1 affords the exchanges a hearing. It affords them an evidentiary hearing. It is not the narrowly defined process that the department would all have us believe. This is, I think somebody in one of the previous hearings said, is an extraordinary proceeding. And I would add to that the admonition that the Texas Supreme Court gave us in General Motors Corporation versus Bloyette, that extraordinary proceedings have the extraordinary potential for abuse. The exchanges are entitled to a hearing. In Morgan versus United States, 304 U.S. 1 at 18, the United States Supreme Court held the right to a hearing embraces not only the right to present evidence, but also a reasonable opportunity to know the claims of the opposing party and to meet them. The right to submit argument implies that opportunity. Otherwise, the right may be but a barren one. Those who are brought into contest with the government in a quasi-judicial proceeding aimed at the control of their activities are entitled to be fairly advised of what the government proposes and to be heard upon its proposals before it issues its final command. The import of the right to hearing granted to the exchanges under Article 5.26-1 is that the exchanges are first entitled to know, Commissioner, and to be fairly advised, Commissioner, of the department's rate determination. I think you would agree with me that the department cannot make a rate determination that results in an unlawful rate. And I think you would agree with me that the commissioner is without authority to promulgate, modify, reduce an unlawful rate. When the legislature enacted SB 14, they amended Article 1.02. And the legislature tells us today that rates in Texas, rates used under this code, must be just, fair, reasonable, adequate, not confiscatory, and not excessive for the risk to which they apply, and not unfairly discriminatory. An insurer may not use rates that violate this article. This statutory requirement that is part of the same legislation by which the legislature enacted Article 5.26-1, which is why we're here today, requires that the department first demonstrate in this proceeding that its rate determination is indeed a lawful determination. Because we've got the department now acting as a rate maker. threshold issue here. And the right to a hearing, the guarantees of the United States Constitution and the Texas Constitution, require that the department fairly apprise the exchanges of its rate determination, and that such determination meets the statutory requirements that rates be just, fair, reasonable, adequate, not confiscatory, and so on. That a rate is adequate does not mean that it satisfies the other requirements of Article 1.02. That the department believes this appeal is confined to the exchangers having to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the rate is inadequate does not mean that the TDI's rate otherwise satisfies the requirements of Article 1.02. Commissioner, we have a determination here that was made behind closed doors without notice and hearing to the exchanges. The exchanges were, in essence, presented with a fait accompli. Notice that your rates are being reduced by 17.5% for homeowners, for residential fire and allied lines, 5%. There is no record of how that rate was determined. There is nothing before the commissioner to indicate that that rate determination, that rate making by the Department of Insurance, results in a lawful rate. And by confining this appeal to the simple issue of adequacy of that rate, does it result in any determination whatsoever that that rate is indeed a lawful rate? Not only are insurers prohibited from using unlawful rates, the TDI can't promulgate, the TDI can't make an unlawful rate. Only after the department proves that its rate determination satisfies the statutory requirements of Article 1.02, then and only then does the burden of proof shift to the exchanges to prove by clear and convincing evidence that that otherwise lawful rate is inadequate as defined in Article 5.142. That is a statutory definition of inadequacy. It's not an actuarial definition of inadequacy. Indeed, I believe Mr. Crawshaw concedes in his pre-filed reports that the statutory definition of inadequacy isn't an actuarial definition. Due process of law requires that before the exchanges must come forward and discharge their burden of proof, that they be fairly apprised that the rate promulgated by the department is a lawful rate. So, whether this is a contested case or not a contested case, I don't know at this point. The department's rules say it is. The general counsel says it isn't. In your opening remark, you talk about taking evidence. At a minimum, it's an evidentiary hearing. And since it is an evidentiary hearing, and since the rights and privileges of the exchanges are affected, they're entitled to due process of law. I would submit to you that the statutory definition of inadequate is unconstitutional. That's an issue for another day. But the issue we can deal with today, under the 5th and 14th Amendments to the United States Constitution, under Article 1, Section 19 of the Texas Constitution, and Article 1, Section 17 of the Texas Constitution, which is separation of powers, is to require procedurally for this hearing that the department proceed first and discharge its burden of proof that this is a lawful rate. Once they have met that burden of proof, then the burden of proof shifts to the exchanges to show that that otherwise lawful rate is inadequate as defined in Article 5.142. That concludes our preliminary matters. Again, we need to deal with Dr. Rappel in addition to the jurisdictional issue and the procedural issue for this hearing. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, do you have any preliminary matters?
No, Commissioner. If you would like, I can respond to a few of the arguments that Mr. Rogers made, or it's your pleasure at this point.
Just respond.
I think, do you mind if I stay sitting? Is that?
Please do.
Thank you. I think what we heard from Mr. Rogers is a longer and maybe a little more detailed argument from the same points that he made at the pre-hearing conference. It was my understanding that those matters were settled at the pre-hearing conference. I've received this morning, about 20 or 30 minutes ago, a brief that Mr. Rogers has written. I've not had the opportunity to review the brief, and if you are interested, I can do that and provide a response brief. But in my view, the matter has been settled at the pre-hearing conference. The issue of jurisdiction, as I said at the pre-hearing conference, yes, it is very clear to anyone who reads 526-1 that the words inter-insurance exchanges do not appear in that statute. However, the case that Mr. Rogers argues in support of his construction of the statute as not applying to his clients, that is the Hitty case. It is a 2000 case, clearly predates the statute in question. The case applies to county mutuals. Clearly, Mr. Rogers' clients are not county mutuals. They are inter-insurance exchanges. However, I understand his logic of applying the language in the case to inter-insurance exchanges because the statutory exemption for exchanges and county mutuals is very similar. What Mr. Rogers does not point out is in the Hitty case and in the statutes, there are actually two ways of getting that exemption. One is that if the statute is specifically enumerated in the provision dealing with, in this case, inter-insurance exchanges. Clearly, that is not the case here. The other way to have an exemption or to get out of the exemption is to have the terms or have the law made applicable by its specific terms. Now, this is where Mr. Rogers and I disagree. I believe that it is not necessary for the words inter-insurance exchange to appear, those specific words do not need to appear in the statute of 526-1. The specific terms of 526-1 incorporate by reference clearly in two separate places in the statute inter-insurance exchanges. Section 1B states clearly that the definitions in Article 5.142 apply to the insurers that are covered under 526-1. The other reference is under Section 2 regarding initial rate filings. It says that each insurer subject to Article 5.142 shall comply with the requirements in the initial rate filing procedure set out in that section. So there are two separate references. Clearly, inter-insurance exchanges are incorporated by the specific terms of 526-1. Another point that is made clear in the Hitty case is they reiterate a general rule of statutory construction, which is When interpreting statutes, the Supreme Court attempts to give effect to the legislature's intent. I don't think there is any question on the part of anyone in this room that the legislature intended, with all its being, for this rate regulation to apply to inter-insurance exchanges, including Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange. I noticed when I was coming in that there are actually some members of legislative staff here today, so if you would like me to call a witness about legislative intent, I could do that. I'll also point out another argument that I've made in the pre-hearing conference, which apparently was not persuasive to Mr. Rogers. Even Farmers does not believe that they are exempted from 526-1. If Farmers truly believed that the statute did not apply to them, why did they make a rate filing under the statute? Why have they engaged in numerous discussions, countless hours of negotiation and discussion about the department's rate indications versus their own actuary's rate indications? Why have they filed an appeal of the notice, the August 8th notice from Chief Actuary Phil Presley? Why have they filed an appeal instead of filing something in district court, a temporary restraining order? There's been no lawsuit in district court. There's been no temporary injunction. Clearly, Farmers itself believes that the statute applies to them. As far as the due process argument goes, Farmers, as I said, has been fairly advised. Again, this was discussed at length during the pre-hearing conference. Staff has researched the issue. I'm sure General Counsel has researched the issue of due process requirements. We are satisfied, and our advice from General Counsel or the Attorney General's office is that the statutory requirements have been met for due process purposes. So we would urge you, Commissioner, to deny the, I think it be entitled it a motion to set aside the rate determination, and we would be happy to work out some arrangement for Mr. Appel's testimony. We would point out that, or Dr. Appel, we would point out that Farmers has been apprised of the hearing and their opportunity to call witnesses at the hearing for several weeks now, and they have chosen not to retain someone to take Dr. Appel's place. Setting that aside, we would be happy to hear a proposal, a reasonable proposal, to handle Dr. Appel's participation or potential rebuttal in response to the documents filed by Betty Patterson, since that is apparently what is driving Mr. Rogers' concerns.
Okay, just a minute. And I did read the pre-hearing conference transcript, and I got to tell you, Mr. Rogers, I'm hard-pressed to disagree with the what's in both the transcript and that was just presented by opposing counsel. I do believe that the Article 526-1 clearly incorporates those definitions that are applicable to 5142. 526-1 clearly requires those insurers subject to Article 5.142 to comply with the requirements of 5.26-1. And I think the statute clearly indicates the jurisdiction over inter-insurance exchanges and the reciprocals or subjects to the provision of 526-1. I'm going to in regards to the jurisdictional issues, I think that there's no question. I mean, having sat through hours and hours and hours of legislative debate, there's no question in my mind, none whatsoever, that the legislature fully intended to cover the interinsurance exchanges without the necessity of calling additional witnesses. As to the burden of proof in the regarding the procedure today, I think the law is also fairly clear that the department was to conduct this initial rate review based on your filing, render an opinion to either approve, disapprove, or modify the rate, notify you of that determination, and then allow you this hearing to rebut that. And this is, in fact, your opportunity. So in terms of your motion, I think I'm going to deny the motion. In fact, the ruling is to deny it. As regards to Dr. Appel, let's go ahead and get through the process today. We'll get you through the introduction of the evidence by Ms. Patterson, and you will have a chance to cross. If at the end of that, we will make a determination of what additional time or what additional arrangements can be made to accommodate Dr. Appel. I think the great majority of the exhibits attached to that affidavit are primarily financial statements prepared by the company. They're Farmer's own documents. They're attached to her affidavit primarily to describe financial condition, financial strength, historical levels of surplus, and so forth. But we can sort of hold off on ruling on the Dr. Appel issue until we get a little bit further down the proceeding, and then we will see what's needed. So, I think that gets us through the preliminary matters. I believe it's time for witnesses. So, all persons here that are going to offer testimony in this case, please stand and raise your right hand to be sworn. Do you and each of you swear or affirm that the testimony you will give in this hearing is the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth? Thank you. Please be seated. So, Mr. Rogers, please call your first witness.
Commissioner? Stephen Weinstein, and I'm going to help out in the presentation of the witnesses. And what I would like to do at the start is to try and give you just a brief statement of an overview of what our witnesses are going to testify to, so you can put it all in some context, and you'll know what you're going to hear. Preliminarily, as I think you probably heard in the State Farm proceeding, we're all at a historic crossroads in the state of Texas with respect to insurance and where you are going to go with respect to the approval of insurance rates. And it seems to me, in reviewing all the testimony, that of Dr. Crawshaw and that of our witnesses, that there are two paths that are before you. There's one path, and I believe that's the one presented by the department, and that path gives the appearance of short-term benefits, that in the short term, if you look at the evidence and data in a very narrow way, it may appear to look favorable to make certain determinations being advocated by the Department of Insurance. But I'm here to submit, and I think our witnesses will show you, that if you choose that path, there will be serious financial consequences for the insurance market in the state of Texas. And those financial consequences will not only impact insurers, but they will impact policyholders. And in the final analysis, the ones who will suffer from choosing the path advocated by the Department of Insurance will be the policyholders in the state of Texas. Now, I say that because, as you will see from the testimony, Dr. Crawshaw has advocated an approach whereby you are to ignore, you have to close your eyes to the evidence, documentation, and supporting information provided by Farmers in their rate filings. You are not to look at that. Notwithstanding the fact that Dr. Crawshaw testified that there's nothing wrong with that data in terms of its quality and how it was compiled. But he says you don't look at that. Rather, you look at industry-wide data. In a sense, you're looking at fictitious information, and you're applying it to a fictitious company and coming up with a fictitious rate. What we are advocating and what our witnesses are advocating is that you should look at the actual data from farmers. You look at their loss trends. You look at their premium trends. You look at their rate of return. You look at the information in the rate filing. And when you do that, you will see that the rate reduction being advocated by the department has no merit. In fact, it will bring this company to the brink of insolvency. It will have an adverse impact on competition in the state of Texas. It will yield an inadequate rate, and it is improper. Rate regulation is a difficult concept. Make no mistake, a variety of states throughout the United States have tried to address the issue of rate regulation. There have been successes and failures. And in those states that have tried to heavily regulate the industry and have made mistakes in the regulation of the industry, have suffered horrendous consequences, as I'm sure the commissioner is aware. Whether you're looking at New Jersey, California, or any other state, you'll see many problems that have been encountered. You have a wonderful opportunity to learn from those mistakes and to create a situation in Texas that is not only healthy for the policyholders, but healthy for the marketplace, so that you can attract new insurance companies into the state and keep those good insurance companies that are already here remaining in the state. That is, it's kind of like we used to always say in jury trials, talk to the jury, you say the bird is in your hand. You have a choice with that bird in your hand. You can either crush that bird or you can let it free and improve competition and improve the marketplace. We believe the TDI's proposal is suggesting that you crush that bird. We don't think that is the appropriate way. In fact, we don't believe that the legislature believes that that's the appropriate way. And the reason I say that is in a report to the legislature, the TDI, on March 28, 2003, submitted their summary report to the legislature for SB 313. And at the end of that report, the TDI made what I think is a very important comment with which farmers is in total agreement. They say at the end of that report, a system of rate regulation would, at a minimum, provide a system of checks and balances. Ideal rate regulation needs to consider rate standards, provide for the filing of rates and supporting documentation, and be flexible enough to recognize the nuances and differences that exist in the market between companies. There is no such thing as one size fits all. And Dr. Crossraw's suggestion that there is simply wrong, and we believe our witnesses will sustain our burden of proof, and we'll explain that to you. And with that, I would like to call our first witness, Ms. Irene Bass.
Excuse me just a second. Did I blow by opening statements?
I think so, but...
But that was a very nice opening statement. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I just have a few comments to make. Can I?
Would you please make them? I'm sorry, I did not meet the procedurally. I sort of got enthralled in the preliminary matters and moved a little too fast. So right before we call on the first witness, please go ahead and make your opening statement.
Thank you. I just have a few comments. Commissioner, as you know, there has been a call from Texans seeking relief from excessive homeowners insurance rates. As you know, the homeowners rate market in Texas has been largely unregulated for many years. It developed, I know you're aware of the history, it started out that a tiny piece of the market was unregulated, and through a loophole in the law, the percentage of market that was unrate regulated grew and grew. In response to that call, which grew louder and louder as the mold problem came about, and there was then form freedom, mold coverage was excluded, the call came to decrease rates as a result of excluding those coverages. As you know, there have been many, many hours of work put into this issue by the governor and his staff, the lieutenant governor and his staff, many, many members of the legislature and their staffs. Your own staff has worked on this innumerable hours. And this hearing is the third now in the series dealing with that issue. This is a very large company, clearly. I think they write currently about $500 million in premium. TDI staff has conducted an intense analysis, actuarial analysis, of the rate filings made by these companies. They have gone through company by company, line by line, issue by issue in the rate filings, and performed extensive analysis and come up with the rate indications. They followed standard actuarial processes, procedures, and principles in coming up with those rate indications. As you know, the rate indication for Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange was a reduction of 17.5%, and 5%, the 17.5% is for homeowners coverage. There was another rate indication of decrease of 5% for dwelling coverage. This is a very important matter for both sides, as I think we will all agree. And I will also agree with Mr. Weinstein's statement that it is even more important to the Texas insureds that are the policyholders of the exchanges. However, I strongly disagree with Mr. Weinstein that if you order, if you uphold the rate reductions, that the policyholders will be penalized somehow. This just clearly flies in the face of logic. If you decide to uphold staff's recommendations of rate reductions of 17.5% for Farmers Insurance Exchange and Fire Insurance Exchange for homeowners coverage and 5% for dwelling, the approximate impact would be $75 million returned to Texas homeowners. Staff will show through the evidence that the rate indication filed by Farmers Exchanges are excessive, that the rate reductions proposed by staff are will produce rates that are adequate, reasonable, and the other statutory standards are met by the staff's indications. We appreciate your time and attention, and we look forward to hearing the rest of the evidence.
Mr. Rogers, I did not mean to cut you short. Mr. Weinstein did present some opening statements. Do you care to add to that?
No, Commissioner.
All right, thank you. Now, please call your first witness.
Ms. Bass?
And let the record reflect that I declined the opportunity to argue further.
Thank you very much. Not like you at all, Professor, today, Mr. Rogers. Let the record reflect.
I just have a few preliminary questions for Ms. Bass, and then I'll ask her to summarize her testimony. Ms. Bass, it's my understanding that you have submitted pre-filed direct testimony and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
Correct.
Do you adopt that testimony as if you had given it live today?
I do.
And could you please summarize your testimony for the Commissioner?
Yes. To begin, I'd like to tell you what my assignment was. And my assignment was from Farmers to make a determination if a rollback of the rates was actuarially justified or not. And what I did in carrying that task out was to review the filing, review data, test some of the elements of the rate calculations, and make that determination. As you know, there are many, many different calculations that go into the rate filing. But today, I'm only going to speak about four of them because they are the major areas of disagreement that remain. One of them is loss trend. Then there's premium trend, the issue of the expense provision, and then the non-hurricane loss provision. And what I'd like to do is to summarize both my direct testimony and then bring in my rebuttal for each of these issues in hopes that it will make more sense and provide for better continuity. So the first thing that I would like to address is lost trend. What I did was I reviewed the data of farmers, I considered the trend they had, and then I did some testing of some alternatives. I considered longer versus short-term trends. I considered what was in the data. I considered if there were any turning points in the data. And I actually came up with alternative rate calculations that are in my pre-filed direct testimony based on different but yet reasonable assumptions for loss trend. I found that given those, my conclusion was that there was no rollback that was warranted overall. And now I'd like to discuss Dr. Crawshaw's approach and my comments on that. What Dr. Crawshaw did was, I'd like to do that in two areas. One, I'd like to talk about how he estimates the annual trend, and then I'd like to talk about how he applies it within the construct of the rate-making formula. So beginning with the estimation of annual trend, Dr. Crawshaw eliminates farmers' loss data from consideration. I did not. I considered farmers' loss trend data. Dr. Crawshaw eliminates it, does not consider it, says that it is contaminated by the presence of wind. Now, what's in the farmers' losses that are considered for trend, and here I'm just talking about what farmers calls non-theft, non-liability losses. There don't seem to be too many issues with the theft and liability. But for farmers, these losses, which are called other losses, include all other perils, excluding water and excluding theft and liability. And they are also limited to $5 million per event for windstorms, and they exclude catastrophic hurricanes as well. That's the definition of farmers' other losses. He looks at those data of farmers, and he compares it to industry wind data. Now, notice that the comparison is farmers, which includes some capped amount of wind plus other, and he compares that to industry wind data. And he does that on his exhibit, which is marked MC-Roman 4. Now, I assume that because those exhibits have an MC in front of it, it stands for Mark Crawshaw, but none of the exhibits bear his name in the documents that I have, so I'm assuming that he either authored them or agrees with them. So if I misspeak by attributing a particular document to Dr. Crawshaw, I apologize, and I'm sure he can correct me at a later time. But what he does is he compares these trends. He actually graphs farmers' trend points against the industry wind. And he says because they follow the same general pattern, he concludes that the farmers' data just are repeating what he calls the vagaries of the wind losses. But in fact, if you look at the graphs, they're done on such a scale. The scale is very limited. It looks like the wind graph for the industry is just a slight increase over time. Well, and so the farmers' data look like they're just a slight increase over time as well. But I suspect that if you looked at a lot of lines of business for their losses per policy, that they would also look like small increases over time. In other words, this is not dispositive. It does not eliminate the fact that you can rely on farmers' data. What he concludes from that is that because farmers' data follows somewhat the wind patterns according to his graph, that you have to eliminate it because it's contaminated by the wind. But you could also probably find that farmers' loss data for homeowners might follow the general trends of automobile insurance, and just because it did, that doesn't mean that it's contaminated by automobile insurance. I also looked at something beyond just the graphs. He also actually had the actual pure premiums listed that he put in that graph, and if you look at the annual changes, they don't change in lockstep. Sometimes the industry wind change is twice as big as farmers. Sometimes it's much smaller. So they don't change in lockstep. So I see that as insufficient proof for eliminating the use of farmers' data from the calculation of the trend. In fact, when I looked at the farmers' loss trend, you can see, and this is in my pre-filed testimony, you can see the regression lines that they came up with for several different periods of time, starting with about 2 years' worth of data going up to about 6 years' worth of data. And for the fire exchange, it was really quite stable, staying in the 4.5% to 5% range. And for the other company, it also was relatively stable. The range was a little bit wider, but it was still pretty stable. So I concluded that one needn't eliminate it. One needed simply to consider the longer-term trends, that is, the 6- or 7-year trends, and then modify them for some turning points, which we seem to see at the more recent times. Because remember, in rate making, we're trying to estimate what's going to happen to the losses about a year from now. We're not trying to figure out long-term trends. We're not trying to figure out what's happened in the industry over the last 25 years and what's going to happen over the next 25. We've got a very short-term goal. And I believe that the farmer's data, given that it is capped with a $5 million cap per event, it includes losses other than caps, is appropriate for use. In his approach, Dr. Crawshaw actually eliminates so many of the losses that are covered by homeowners and then applies it to all of the losses that I wonder if I'm really very concerned that it doesn't match properly. I mean, he has eliminated all the water losses, as he should, because that's not covered anymore, and Farmers has eliminated that too. He eliminates all the wind losses, calculates an industry trend for the remaining losses, and then applies it to Farmers for everything. And I find that that's very that there is just a mismatch there, and that that's not necessary to do that. I should say that he doesn't really apply it to everything because the hurricane provision is done separately. So, but he does apply it to non-hurricane catastrophe losses. What he did in estimating the annual trend is what I just discussed. Now I'd like to talk about his application of it within the rate-making formula. And one of those things is that he takes this trend that's calculated from losses from the industry that completely exclude wind, and he applies this to Farmers, and he applies it not only to Farmers, he applies it to Farmers all of the losses except the hurricane losses. So he's applying this to theft, liability, to fire losses, to aircraft falling onto your roof, and he's applying it to wind losses other than hurricane. Now, it is Dr. Crawshaw's contention that wind exhibits no short-term trend. However, the trend that he calculates for the other losses is basically, I guess, what Dr. Crawshaw would consider a short-term trend. It's based upon about 5 or 6 years' worth of data. The trend for losses is actually composed of two different components. One is the severity component, that is, the average size of the claim. The other is the frequency component, that is, how often are these claims going to occur. It's Dr. Crawshaw's contention that windstorm claims vary considerably. And yet, when he applies the industry loss trend to the wind claims for Farmers, he's implicitly saying the industry severity trend applies and the industry frequency trend applies. So there's a logical disconnect between what he says about the fact that you cannot predict the frequency of windstorm losses, and yet he uses frequency from other losses and applies it to wind. Now, that has a profound effect on things, actually, because according to the calculations I have, his industry severity trend is around 14%, but his industry frequency trend is minus 8. So when you combine that, you get something around 4.5% for what we call the pure premium, which is simply the multiplication of the frequency with the severity. That means that in applying the loss trend of 4.5 to farmers' wind losses, that he's implicitly including within that a minus 8% frequency change, even though he says you can't predict these things. I think what would be more appropriate, if you're going to follow Dr. Crawshaw's approach, would be to at least recognize that you can't predict. If he says you can't predict the severity, I'm sorry, if he says you can't predict the frequency, then he should have left the frequency out and used only the severity portion of the trend to apply to wind losses. Now, I did an alternate calculation of that in my rebuttal testimony, and if he had done that, he would have gotten a very much higher loss and loss adjustment expense ratio. In fact, it would have been about 11 percentage points higher, all other things being equal. And now I'd like to take a break to get some water. There are also a few other technical areas of application of the loss trend with which I disagree. Dr. Crawshaw does not consider historical trend separate from future trend. For lines of business such as homeowners, where we tend to use 5 or sometimes more years of experience, it's important to consider the trend properly. And oftentimes when you have lines of business like this, it's better to consider the premium trend in two different segments. One is to look at your past year's experience and see what the past trend actually was and bring those loss experience, those loss data up to the current cost level based on the trends that have been historically observed. Then you have the situation where you have to then take those losses, because they're only at today's costs, or actually at the cost of the most recent data that you have, which in this case for farmers would be the first quarter of 2003, and you have to project them to the time frame that's appropriate for when these policies are going to take place, which would be, in the case of farmers, 1.75 years of a projection. Now, sometimes things change, and what's happened in the past isn't necessarily going to happen in the future, so it's very good in a case like this to separate the trend into two areas. Dr. Crawshaw ignores this, and he uses his estimate of future trend and applies it over the entire period. I might also say that he doesn't directly apply loss trend. He applies loss trend divided by premium trend, which is kind of a net trend, or you can call it a loss ratio trend. So he doesn't apply it directly, but because he calculates it, loss trend, and then he calculates premium trend and takes the division of it, he's effectively applying it. So I'd like to make that clear in terms of the technical comments. And I also think that his trend period is too short. He has projected these losses out for a year and a half. They should be projected out for 1.75 years to reflect 1 year beyond the proposed effective date, which in the farmer's rate filing was July 1st, and he only trends them until March 31st. Normally you would do this 1 year beyond the proposed effective date, because that's the average date of loss for policies that are going to be in effect with rates beginning for 1 year on July 1st, 2003. What he's done is he's shortened the time period, so it's not a big point. It counts for maybe 0.2 of a percentage point, but it needed to be mentioned. And those are my comments on his loss trend. Now I'd like to shift to premium trend. And again, let me tell you what I did, and then my comments on Dr. Crawshaw. I looked at the farmers' premium data. I saw that there were considerable downward trends in the premium. That was on an average premium basis per policy. And then I looked at it component by component to see if I could figure out what was going on that was causing this and whether or not this would be happening in the future. Contained in my Appendix B to my pre-filed direct testimony are some charts that were supplied by Mr. Tucker to Mr. Presley through the email. And these contain information on a variety of rating factors. And you can see that the change in the rating factors is decreasing over time. And I think that many of them can be expected now to continue to decrease. I think that FIPRA, which is the Farmers, I'll never get this right, so I won't even try to remember the acronym. It's the risk rating that they do for credit scores. That has had tremendous downward trends. It's probably not going to continue at that rate, but it will continue. There's no sign that it was necessarily just to stop. And there are other rating factors where you can see on those charts that they go down. So I believe that it was reasonable to continue to anticipate that there was going to be some decrease in premium trend. And I think in my alternative calculations for the two homeowners companies, I assumed that there would be a negative 2% trend going forward. And for the fire company, I think I assumed a plus 3. What Dr. Crawshaw did, in contrast to that, was that he, again, threw away Farmers' data. But in this case, he doesn't even talk about it at all. In the case of loss trend, Dr. Crawshaw did provide some discussion of what he did to consider the industry trend, but he provides no discussion of why he believes Farmers' premium trend data are unreliable. Now, premium trend data comes from average premiums per policy that are adjusted at various levels, and they're not subject to the windstorm the way that losses are subject. They don't have that within them, and so I don't think that that would be a reason for excluding them, but I really don't know why Dr. Crawshaw did exclude them. I think that it's my opinion that all costs need to be included in the rates that are associated with the transfer of risk. And if you fail to capture the appropriate premium trend, then you won't be capturing all of the costs associated with it. His goal, he says, in one of his documents, is to evaluate companies based on their own data. And he has the chance to use, the opportunity to use Farmers' data for premium, and he chooses not to. Now, one might say, should he use industry premium trend because he uses industry loss trend to be consistent? But you don't need to do that. In fact, by Dr. Crawshaw's imputing that industry loss trend applies to Farmers, what he's really saying is that the industry loss trend is like the Farmers' trend. It's a good substitute for that. It's a surrogate for Farmers' trend. Hence, he's basically estimating Farmers' loss trend. He's using it doing other data, but he thinks that it's Farmers' loss trend that he will be estimating. So if you then shift to the premium side of things, why not use the premium data from Farmers? It's a much better estimate. It matches because Dr. Crawshaw already thinks that the loss trend that he has estimated from industry data matches the loss trend that will be expected for Farmers. So why not continue and match things, but get a better estimate by using the actual Farmers' data, because it's not subject to the kinds of things for which Dr. Crawshaw rejected the loss trend. It's not subject to the vagaries of the wind in that way. But he didn't do it. And by not doing it, he eliminated capturing a lot of changes in the rating classes. For example, when we start out the rate-making procedure by putting premiums at the current rate level, you do that by adjusting them according to the prior rate changes. And Farmers' rate filing has a list of prior rate changes. But those rate changes were the rate changes that were estimated at the time that rate change calculation was done. What happens sometimes, though, is that if you change some of your rating factors, such as for the introduction of FIPRA or any other changes, those insureds who get the higher rates because of the introduction of different rating variables will often leave the company, especially if other companies haven't introduced that. They'll say, gee, I don't like this rate increase, it's too much, and they'll go someplace else. So insurance companies, if they introduce on a phased-in basis risk rating factors, sometimes will lose the higher rated risks. What happens is that they don't realize all of the premium change that they thought they were going to realize when they estimated it at the time they did the rate calculation. Now, the way to account for this small loss of premium is to consider the premium trend, because if these high-rated risks leave, then you will see the average premiums decline. So this offsets that in the rate-making situation, but since Dr. Crawshaw didn't consider Farmers' premium trend, he's not able to compensate for that. Now I'd like to move on to expenses. With respect to Farmers' expenses, what I did was I reviewed the expenses that were in the Farmers' filing. I understand that Farmers pays these amounts basically contractually, and it is a percentage of premium. They pay commissions to their agents as a percentage of premium. They pay premium tax as a percentage of premium to the state, and Farmers pays for its other expenses contractually to its provider of services as a percentage of premium. Hence, the percentage of premium is the way that Farmers pays its expenses. Now, other companies may not operate that way. Other companies may incur expenses however they incur them, and by virtue of the fact that everybody has to fill out the same insurance expense exhibit and is required to state these as percentages of premium, doesn't mean that other companies incur them as a percentage of premium. But Farmers does. Hence, it's appropriate to include the expenses for Farmers as a percentage of premium because that's what they actually pay. Dr. Crawshaw, on the other hand, believes that Farmers should pay something less than what it actually pays. Well, actually, let me restate that. They believe that Farmers should only be permitted to include in its rate an amount less than what Farmers actually will pay. This violates the principles of rate making, which are there's a longer term to that. It's the statement of principles regarding property casualty actuarial rate making. It's promulgated by the board of directors of the Casualty Actuarial Society, of which Dr. Crawshaw and I are both members. And it says in principle 2 that one needs to include all the costs of the transfer of risk. By eliminating some of Farmers' expenses, Dr. Crawshaw is failing to comply with that principle. Initially, I didn't quite understand what his expenses were because he did it on a number of different bases. He did it on three different bases. One was the actual Farmers' figures. One was he substituted the industry average in. And then the third basis was that he used an industry average that was adjusted to reflect the fact that Texas homeowners is more expensive than in other states on average. And the rate changes that he obtained by using those last two scenarios bracketed the minus 17.5% rollback. So I could presume from that the expenses that he was proposing to use for Farmers were somewhere slightly lower than the industry average. I think that this is inappropriate for a number of reasons. First of all, as I just said before, Farmers actually incurs its expenses on a percentage of premium basis. The other is that he fails to take company differences into consideration when he's looking at this. Not all companies operate the same way. Averages are averages, and we know that they don't tell the whole story. It's like the old actuarial joke of the actuary who's got his or her head in the oven and his feet in the bucket of water and says, on average, I'm quite comfortable, thank you. So you have to consider how all of the other companies operate to make that comparison. He doesn't do that. He simply uses the average, reduces it, and applies it to Farmers. It's interesting that even the insurance code understands that not all companies are alike. The insurance code says that there will be variation in expenses because it defines disallowed expenses as those above 110% of the median expenses for insurance companies for expenses other than premium tax and other than acquisition expenses. So clearly the code recognizes that companies operate differently one from the other. Dr. Crawshaw himself in his deposition, when asked a question about expenses, said, well, this is the average, but, you know, there's always variation from the average. That's not an exact quote. That's a paraphrase. But even though he admits and understands that there is variation in companies from the average, he doesn't permit it for Farmers and, in fact, wants them to be below the industry average. He ignores how Farmers actually incurs the expenses by adjusting them then to reflect the fact that the premiums in Texas are higher. What this does is if you assume that the Texas premiums are higher, it reduces as a percentage of premium the industry average loss in his calculation. And I think that this is going to do harm to Farmers. This is going to do harm to other companies because if the only variation that Dr. Crawshaw allows is a downward variation, then there's not going to be enough expense money in Farmers' rates or in other insurance company rates. And this is going to cause a widespread inadequacy. And the final topic is that of the, and this is always hard to say, it's the non-hurricane catastrophe provision. So we're taking the catastrophe losses out. We don't seem to have any of the hurricanes out. We don't have any disagreement on that. And so if I speak about catastrophe losses in this particular instance, please know that I'm not talking about hurricanes. What Farmers does is it observes its history over about a 15-year period, and it looks at the relationship from quarter to quarter between all of the losses and then the losses excluding windstorm losses above $5 million. Windstorm losses, I have a hard time saying this. It's easy to look at it mathematically. They look at the relationship between losses that have the windstorms in and then the losses that don't have the windstorms in. They then look at those ratios that they have, and if any individual ratio thus constructed is greater than the mean of those ratios plus 3 times the standard deviation, they cap it at the mean plus 3 times the standard deviation. This means that some losses are removed by this process from the rate-making process if you simply stop at this point. What Farmers then does is it takes the average capped ratio, multiplies it by its losses that exclude the wind in order to provide for a smoothed amount of wind losses. But remember, some of those ratios have been capped at the mean plus 3 times the standard deviation. If they hadn't been capped, you could say that you were considering all the losses. But the fact that they're capped means that they would forever be lost to the rate-making system. So what Farmers does is it takes all the losses that get capped across the country for all states, and then it reallocates those back to states on two bases. It reallocates them back as a percentage of premium, and it reallocates them back as a percentage of losses. In doing that, it makes sure that it accounts for all of the losses and that nothing gets lost in the system. What Dr. Crawshaw proposes to do is he proposes not to cap those and simply to take the 15-year average of those ratios uncapped and put them into the rate-making process in order to estimate a smoothed amount of wind losses. What happens here is that he's letting more instability into the rates than otherwise would be there under the Farmers procedure. If you do what Dr. Crawshaw suggests, then when Texas does have one of those very large windstorm losses that results in a loss ratio that otherwise would have been capped, it'll go into the rate making on an uncapped basis if you use Dr. Crawshaw's procedure, and it will contribute to greater rate instability. Those conclude my comments on my testimony and my rebuttal testimony. And in summation, I would just like to reiterate that I, after determination of, or actually after consideration of what Farmers did and after consideration of what Dr. Crawshaw did, it remains my opinion that overall no rollback is warranted for these Farmers companies.
Commissioner, may I just, before I pass the witness, clarify a couple of points that I think would be very helpful, and that is, with respect to the issue you take with the department's view of the premium and the loss trend, can you explain for us what impact that has in terms of the overall rate reduction? And what I'm trying to get at is, as I understand your testimony, by selecting the premium trend that Dr. Crawshaw selected, which was an industry-wide premium trend, and applying that to his loss trend, he was able to develop a very low loss ratio. I believe it was 0.7%.
Commissioner, can I just clarify, is this witness providing testimony, or is there a question here?
I'm working on a question. I'm getting there. I'm just trying to summarize what I understand, and then I will ask. I'll ask it this way. Can you...
It seems to me that he's actually providing testimony about his interpretation, and I would ask that that be stricken.
I'll ask it in the form of a question.
Thank you.
What is the significance of how Dr. Crawshaw considered premium trend and loss trend in terms of the impact on the loss ratio he used in the calculation?
It causes a much lower loss ratio than would be there if one had considered Farmers' loss and premium trend.
And what is the relationship between a lower loss ratio and the rollback that is suggested by the department?
Well, it would suggest a much lesser rollback than what Dr. Crawshaw has proposed.
And if the loss ratio were higher, is it fair to say then that the rate reduction would be lower?
Yes, the rate reduction would be less in absolute terms. So instead of a minus 17.5, I don't know what it would be, but it would probably be minus 5 or minus 6, something like that.
And switching gears to the expense capping that Dr. Crawshaw did, as I understand from your testimony, what is the impact on capping the expenses in arriving at the rollback that Dr. Crawshaw suggested?
It would also serve to reduce his rollback if you were to use the Farmers' actual expenses.
So is it a fair statement to say that by the technique he used with respect to the loss ratio and the technique he used with respect to the expense capping, he was able to generate a higher rollback?
Oh, yes, a much higher rollback.
And then with respect to the catastrophe provision that you referred to, and I think it's the extreme event provision as it's referred to in filing, is it a fair statement to say by rejecting the Farmers' approach in the rate filing, and employing his own approach, that too enabled him to generate a higher rollback.
That's correct.
And as I understand your testimony, that given Dr. Crawshaw's methodology, if in the future a catastrophe event occurred, then that would have to be taken into account, and then perhaps in the following year, there would need to be a significant rate increase for farmers if they employed that methodology.
Yes, that's correct.
Now, have you had an opportunity to review an affidavit filed by Dr. Crawshaw at about 9 o'clock this morning?
Well, yes.
And could you please tell us if you have any comments or any thoughts with respect to what he filed at 9 o'clock this morning?
Yes, and these are preliminary comments because I really didn't have very much time to review this, but I'm referring to that affidavit on page 2. Dr. Crawshaw says, I did not perform a separate analysis of premium and loss trend for farmers. Instead, I analyzed the loss ratio trend. However, I have concluded that the loss trend analysis performed by farmers is seriously flawed. I'm troubled by that statement because he says he didn't perform an analysis of the trends for farmers, but yet he's concluded that they're flawed. I also don't see that he analyzed the loss ratio trend for farmers. What I see is that he basically rejected the farmers' data and used industry data. But I don't see that he did an analysis directly of the farmers' loss and premium trend data. In fact, this is one of the things I suggested in my testimony, is that he really should have looked at the farmers' data itself and seen if there was stability there. He did this little graph that compared farmers' data to industry wind, which isn't really a view of the farmers' data, but the farmers' data really aren't all that stable. And if he were to do that, I think he would see that the farmers' data are usable for the purpose to which they're put in this context. He goes on at the bottom of page 2 and then the top of page 3 and talks about the fact that it's inappropriate to consider farmers' loss trend because it has wind losses in there. And I would just like to clarify that, yes, there are some wind losses in there, but they are limited to $5 million per event. So it doesn't sound, it's not quite as extreme as perhaps this language of Dr. Crawshaw suggests. He then on page 3 continues and talks about how he has proved that you can't use a 6-year or otherwise a short-term trend. And he says that what he did was he examined the long-term industry wind experience, and based on that, he went back in time and applied the 6-year trend method, and he then compared the results of the 6-year trend method to the experience that subsequently emerged. And this indicated to him that it was flawed. Now, I don't recall seeing a study like this. Perhaps it's in the papers and I don't recognize it, but I don't think that I've seen this study that he's done. And if I had, I would like to look at it for some things that I think would be of concern. If you go back and you attempt to test to see whether you got your estimate right or not, you have to make sure you neutralize it for all other things that could affect it other than the fact that your estimate wasn't a good estimate. This is a very difficult thing to do when you're estimating things that happen according to weather and actions of human beings and things that respond to behavior. So I don't know how we would have done it, but it would be important to see if he'd neutralized for anything else that got in there. I haven't seen this report. I don't know how he draws that conclusion. The only thing I can see is this graph that he has on one of his charts that shows industry wind experience, and he graphs it against farmers' other experience, which, of course, includes a whole host of other things.
Another question?
Yes. If you could turn to page...
Well, I'm still... I'm sorry. I should have indicated that I wasn't finished, and I was just... I have to go through here to see where my comments are. I'm not finished yet, which doesn't mean Mr. Weinstein won't have questions for me anyway. He says on page 5 of his testimony that his analysis doesn't separately consider loss and premium trends, but instead uses loss ratio trends. But in fact, his study does consider loss and premium trends. They're calculated right there in exhibits of his. What he does in the end is he takes the loss trend and divides it by the premium trend so that when he applies it as a single number, which could be called the loss ratio trend. But he definitely analyzes them separately, so I don't understand why he says he didn't do that. And then the other thing that I find curious is on page 7 when Dr. Crawshaw talks about expenses as a percentage of premium. And he's asked, or he asks himself, I guess, in writing this testimony, do you agree that the expense payments that farmers will actually pay for premium, tax, management fee, and commissions will amount to about 31.4% of premium as estimated by farmers? And he says yes. Then he goes on and says, did you use this? And he says, no, I didn't use it. And then the question is, why didn't you use it? And he says, well, according to actuarial principles, the expense and the rate should reflect the cost associated with issuing and servicing Texas homeowners policies. And he says, a method that allocates cost as a percentage of premium is unfair to Texas policyholders and doesn't reflect costs. Well, those statements don't reflect the reality of farmers. Farmers actually does incur these losses. These are what farmers paid. They're not based on some allocation of expenses that are incurred some other way. Farmers incurs these expenses as a percentage of premium. So this is not a logical argument for why farmers' expenses ought to be reduced. Now, let me page a little more. I think that's the end of my comments here because I am not offering any comments about rate of return and the underwriting profit because Dr. Appel will be addressing those.
Just one last area. You mentioned that, like Dr. Crawshaw, you are a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society?
That's correct.
And what is the Casualty Actuarial Society?
Casualty Actuarial Society is the organization that does research on casualty and property actuarial matters, that is responsible for actuarial education, that administers and tests actuaries to see if they qualify to be either a fellow of the Casualty Actuarial Society or an associate of the Actuarial Society. We also maintain principals and conduct meetings at which research is presented.
And I notice your background is attached as Appendix 80, your testimony, but you were a past president of the Casualty Actuarial Society?
Yes, about 10 years ago.
And presently, you chair a committee for the Casualty Actuarial Society?
That's right. I'm chair of the Casualty Actuarial Society Discipline Committee.
Thank you. No more questions, Mr. Commissioner, and I pass the witness.
Good morning, Ms. Bass.
Good morning.
Ms. Bass, can you state the name of your firm for us?
Bass & Corey Incorporated.
Can you tell us the members of your firm?
Yes, two people, Irene Bass and Stan Corey, who is my husband.
Okay. Ms. Bass, when were you retained in this matter?
A few weeks ago. I would be hard-pressed to put a date on it.
Okay. Who retained you?
Mr. Tucker called me.
Okay. So would that be the Farmers Group, Inc.? Were you retained by the Farmers Group, Inc.? What is the name of the entity to whom you send your bills?
Well, I send them to Mr. Tucker, and I believe he's an employee of Farmers Group Incorporated. I believe he's an employee of the management company. It's called the management company.
Okay. And I think you stated in your direct, you were describing your assignment. Has your husband also been retained by Farmers?
Not to give expert opinion.
But has he been retained by Farmers?
He has done some work for Farmers, yes.
In connection with this matter?
Yes.
Have you been retained by Farmers previously?
Yes.
How many times?
I'd have to just estimate maybe 10 to 20 times, but okay. I'd have to check my files.
Okay. How about your husband?
I think he has been retained. This is his second time that he was retained by them.
What?
Although I might say that he has done peer review for my work in almost everything that I've done, but that's never been him doing work directly for Farmers.
Okay. When was the first year you were retained by Farmers? Do you recall?
Well, I can bracket it somewhere in the 1989 to 1991 time frame.
Ms. Bass, what did you review in conducting your analysis? Can you give us a list of the documents you looked at?
Yes, I reviewed the rate filings of Farmers for homeowners for the Farmers Insurance Exchange, the Fire Insurance Exchange, and the Dwelling Fire filing for the Fire Insurance Exchange. And I reviewed the documents that are included in Appendix B to my testimony. And then I also subsequently reviewed, in the course of doing rebuttal testimony, those documents given to me that were produced by Dr. Crawshaw.
Okay, so the filings, there were three filings, the documents in Appendix B, and Dr. Crawshaw's analysis and his supporting documents?
Yes.
That's all?
I think so.
Did you review the policy forms?
I have looked at policy forms in the past. I didn't particularly look at them this time. I mean, there's a fair number of things that I've looked at in the past that I didn't review again now.
Okay. Did you review data from other companies writing insurance, homeowners insurance in Texas?
Only those which were included in Dr. Crawshaw's testimony.
And did you review any other testimony besides Dr. Crawshaw's testimony?
I reviewed the testimony of other Farmers' witnesses, Dr. Appel's testimony, Mr. Tucker's testimony.
Okay, that's great. Ms. Bass, you've previously testified in benchmark rate cases. Have you testified in residential property benchmark cases?
Yes.
On behalf of whom?
On behalf of I don't know their exact names, but some of the Farmers' companies that were writing business here that were rate regulated.
Okay. Do you remember the last year you testified in a property benchmark rate hearing?
This is quite a memory contest. Probably 96, in around there.
Okay. About how many residential property benchmark rate hearings have you testified in? Just a rough number?
Two or three of them.
Okay.
Probably.
Were you recommending a rate increase in each of those hearings?
Oh, I don't remember. Just don't remember.
You listed several publications. Are any of these publications that you've done specifically related to homeowners insurance?
Yeah, I doubt it, but have to look at that list. And let me get my testimony out here. No, none of those is specific to homeowners, but homeowners could certainly be one of the lines of business that's considered in each of those papers, but it's nothing specific to homeowners.
Okay. I did notice several presentations on the topic of the actuary as expert witness. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I was looking at my publications. Were you asking me before about my publications or my presentations?
Now I'm asking you about your presentations.
Okay. Yes, there are a number of those. I guess about four times I did that.
Ms. Bass, can I get you to turn to page 5 of your direct testimony?
Yes.
About halfway down the page, you state, loss experience of Farmers Insurance Exchange that comes from...
Can you give me the line number on that, please?
13.
Thank you.
Loss experience of Farmers Insurance Exchange that comes from HOB policies is adjusted, limited to reflect only the coverage provided in the basic HOA policy. But you've stated that you did not review the policy forms in preparing your testimony.
Well, I didn't read them now, is what I said. I'm familiar with the coverages in them and have reviewed them in the past, and I know that what Farmers did was eliminate water damage, basically, and that's the that's one of the differences between HOB and HOA. That's the major difference, and that's the adjustment that Farmers made.
Okay. Do you know who at Farmers made those adjustments?
I presume it's somebody in their data processing department, but I don't have a name for you.
Okay. Can I get you to turn to page 4 of your direct?
Yes.
I think you state that you did not perform any analysis to verify the accuracy of the data. Line 6.
Yes, I made that statement. That's a general statement that is true for virtually every assignment that I do. I am not a data auditor, and I do reasonableness checks as other actuaries do.
Okay. And it is appropriate to do those types of checks?
Yes, for to find sort of reasonableness determinations, but that's very different from a data audit.
Okay. Can I get you to flip back to page 2 of your testimony? You state that you relied on Farmers' work. Is that correct?
I'm sorry, I was drinking water. What line are you at, please?
Page 2, lines 18 through 25. You did not perform an independent analysis that appears on line 20.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And then can I get you to go back to page 4? Starting on page 11, you state that you were made aware of an accidental omission of a rate change.
Yes, I was.
But that did not cause you to change any of your analysis?
Oh, I reflected that in my analysis, yes, because when I did my analysis, I used the corrected rate changes and the exhibits that are included in my pre-filed direct testimony include the corrections to the premium changes that had been inadvertently omitted in the original Farmers filings.
Did it cause you to have any type of a heightened awareness or a heightened sense of need for those reasonable checks we were talking about?
No.
Are you aware that TDI has found certain data problems with certain problems with Farmers' data in the past?
I'm not aware of anything that Dr. Crawshaw found in terms of data problems.
But are you aware from your discussions with Mr. Tucker of such problems?
I have no specific information that's relevant to any recent time period. I know that probably 5 or 6 years ago, I remember the TDI having some concern, but I can't remember what it was, and I don't know how it was addressed.
Okay, so you've not discussed it with Mr. Tucker?
He's not brought it to my attention. I'm not aware of any specific concerns on the part of the TDI with respect to Farmers' data quality.
Okay. You stated that you follow the CAS principles in conducting your review. In your opinion, do rate indications depend on the accuracy of the data underlying the projections?
They can.
Not always?
No, not always.
Did you conduct any analysis of farmer solvency?
No.
Have you had a chance to look at Mr. Appel's rebuttal testimony?
I looked at it very briefly this morning.
I don't suppose you have a copy in front of you.
I suppose you're right.
I'm going to read you a statement from Dr. Appel. If farmers paid an unreasonable amount for services, that would show up in its requested expense provisions. And it is my understanding that farmers have supported those expense provisions through the testimony of their actuaries. Do you have any response to that statement?
It's hard to respond because I don't know in what context he's speaking about that. Is this in terms of rate of return or
what? I'll read you the paragraph. In judging the reasonableness of farmers' rates, it makes perfect sense for a regulator to review the company's selected expense provisions. Expenses are a component of the rate which should be neither excessive nor inadequate, but reviewing the reasonableness of the expense provision has nothing to do with the relationship between the company selling homeowners insurance in Texas and any other corporate entities. How farmers chooses to arrange its corporate affairs and the firms from which it purchases services are not issues in this hearing at all. And here's the quote. If farmers paid an unreasonable amount for services, that would show up in its requested expense provisions, and it is my understanding that farmers has supported those expense provisions through the testimony of their actuaries. Do you have any response to that?
Yeah, I'm not too sure what he means, show up. And that's not a sort of an actuarial term of art.
But you've not provided any testimony to support those expense provisions today?
Yes, I have, in the sense that these, I understand from the farmer's actuary, Mr. Tucker, that these are the expenses that are paid. I have an understanding of how farmers pays its expenses in terms of the commissions and in terms of the certainly the premium expense, premium tax expense, and in terms of the fees that it pays to its attorney, in fact. So I know how it incurs those, and they are incurred as a percentage of premium.
Do you think it would be appropriate to include unreasonable expenses in the rate?
Generally, no. Generally, expenses should be reasonable, and these expenses are reasonable.
Okay. I think you were talking about a capping procedure in late in your testimony just now. Do you recall that testimony?
With respect to wind losses?
I was just going to say objection, vague and ambiguous. I'm not too sure to what she's referring to.
This is in relation to the wind losses, the capping procedure.
Yes, there is a capping procedure in place in farmers' wind procedure, I'll call it.
Okay, and it's to exclude. You stated that it was the capping procedure was implemented to exclude those extreme events. Is that correct?
It includes some extreme events. It permits large events to be smoothed in their experience. But when the event is very large, it caps the amount and it takes those extremely large events and takes some of the excess losses out of the procedure and then it adds them back in on a smooth basis.
And yet, in your rebuttal testimony on page 17, I believe, you explained that there is a load for these very large losses to be added back in.
Well, that's right. They're taken out, and then they are aggregated over all the states, and then they are smoothed and put back in on two bases. One is in relation to premium, and one is in relation to losses.
Okay, so they're not just taken out and you never see them again. They're taken out, and then you put them back in.
Well, not exactly. I mean, that suggests I take a dollar out and I put a dollar back in. They're taken out from Texas, and they're taken out from other states that are subject to a similar process as Texas. And then whatever is removed that's excess is added up. I'm simplifying this, but it's added up. And then it's reallocated back to states on a smooth basis so that no state suffers at any point in time from an extreme wind event.
And can you tell us the reason for the capping procedure?
Yes, the reason is to promote rate stability.
Are you aware of the history of farmers' rate changes during the last two to three years?
They're stated in the rate filings as corrected, yes.
I'm going to read to you from, this is Exhibit 4A, I believe, to the farmers' homeowners rate filing.
I'm sorry, exhibit which?
It's Exhibit 4A to the farmers' homeowners rate filing. Page 2 of Exhibit 4A.
I have a farmers' rate filing. I have Exhibit 4A. I don't have a page 2 to it, though.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical. If I told you that farmers had modified its rates starting in July of 1999 with a 23% increase, April of 2000, 3.7% increase, August of 2000, 13.1% increase, September of 2000, 7.8% increase, November of 2000, negative 0.1% decrease, September of 2001, 29% increase, December of 2001, 19.6% increase. Does that sound like the rates have been stable to you?
Well, I think this addresses a different issue, and that's if one comes from a perspective where the rates were grossly inadequate, then one has to take action to get them up. And if, in fact, they were grossly inadequate, and if, in fact, things change, then they need to respond.
But does that sound like stable rates to you?
Well, I think that given the circumstances, they're probably as stable as they can be. I think they'd be worse in terms of high increases followed by low decreases if they didn't consider the windstorms on a smooth basis, because if you had a hurricane, you'd probably see these numbers be, you know, a 700% increase. So I think that, yes, indeed, compared to that, these are stable.
Okay. You were talking earlier about your catastrophe provision, and in your opinion, following a major catastrophe, would it be typical to see a market disruption? Would you consider a market disruption to be a practical impact of a major catastrophe, such as restrictions in coverage?
It depends on what the kind of catastrophe is. If the catastrophe is a mass tort that nobody ever thought was going to happen and that just sort of appeared one day, then I think there probably is going to be a market disruption because companies can't respond to that. If it's a big windstorm, and if windstorm modeling is done appropriately, then there probably won't be as much of a disruption in the marketplace. However, I think that as technology changes and as companies are able to understand better and model better catastrophes, that there are some changes that they put in, but hopefully there's not much of a market disruption.
You talked earlier in your testimony about premium trend.
That's correct.
And you were talking about the implementation of the FIPRA program?
Yes.
And you were stating that adjustments would be made following the implementation of the FIPRA program, and I think, and tell me if I'm misstating your conclusion, I thought your conclusion was that implementation of programs like the FIPRA program would contribute to decrease in the premium trend. Is that correct?
Yes, they have.
Do you have any opinion about what the introduction of the FIPRA program did to the loss ratio?
I would have to do a little more analysis to that because here the losses already reflected the introduction of the FIPRA program, and so the premiums need to reflect that as well. In other words, whatever losses were incurred by farmers were incurred from risks that were subject to the FIPRA program, and so of course they are in that program and in that loss experience. The premiums also need to reflect that, and they would if you take the premium trend into consideration, including the impact of that. But I haven't done a separate study on FIPRA for purposes of this.
Okay. So is it your opinion that FIPRA would cause premium trend to decrease but would have no effect on loss ratio? I'm asking for a clarification.
No, that's not my testimony. My testimony is that the effects of FIPRA are in both the losses and the premiums of farmers because farmers' experience contains the experience of all of its insureds, and they're all now subject to FIPRA. So it's there in their the experience is the loss experience of all the people who are classified according to FIPRA, and the premiums are all the premiums that are generated by using FIPRA. But I haven't done an independent study to see how the loss ratios are by each FIPRA category, for example. I haven't done that here.
Okay. No further questions.
I have nothing to add here. We have some more witnesses to go.
This might be a good time to break if you want to take lunch breaks.
Very good.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Commissioner.